Well, hey, everybody, it is great to see you, and a special welcome if you're joining us online from wherever you happen to be. Now, as many of you know, we are in the midst of an epic 12-part series called Lessons from the Land. It's all about some of the cool stuff that I learned while preparing to lead a study trip to Turkey this past fall. And once again today, I want to begin our time in the same way we began each morning of our trip by reciting a few verses from the Old Testament together in Hebrew. And if you're here for the first time, you think that's weird. It's a little weird around here, but we're just kind of going with it. If we all do it, it's not weird, you know. And one person's like, I'm not doing it. I'm like, that's okay. We're not following up with you. But anyway, we recite it in Hebrew, which is the original language of the Old Testament, and then in English. The verses in question are found in a document that we call Deuteronomy and are widely regarded as being the most important command in all of the Jewish law. So you'll find 613 different commands that God gave ancient Israel. This one is number one with a bullet, and in English, they read like this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. And again, like with everything in you, seek to love God. And so what I'd love to do is invite you to stand now if you're able, and I'll give you this verse in Hebrew in bite-sized chunks, and you can repeat it back to me, and then we'll do the English together. So here we go. We'll put it up on the screen. Repeat after me. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Much ching. Very nice. Okay. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Eloheka. He said, God bless you. Right. All right, now the English. Hear, O Israel. The Lord is our God. The Lord alone. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength. Amen. All right, go ahead and grab a seat. Well done, team. Love it. All right, so to get us going with what I want to talk to you about today, I want to show you another rendering that I had my digital research assistant at ChatGPT create for me in like 3 seconds. Don't ask me how that works. I think there's nuclear energy involved. But anyway, this is a rendering of what was a major pilgrimage site for early Christians. It was called the Martyrium of Philip, and it was constructed around the year 400 AD in a city called Hierapolis in modern Turkey. So here's a map to give you a sense of the city's location relative to the two other cities we've talked about so far in the series. We started, of course, on the coast in Antalya, and then for 2 weeks we were in Pisidian Antioch, and then today we find ourselves in Hierapolis. But anyway, the martyrium was built to honor the memory of a man named Philip, who had been one of Jesus' first disciples. And according to tradition, he was martyred or murdered in Hierapolis around 80 AD because of his faith in Jesus. And that becomes very, very important because of what I want to talk to you about today. So, interestingly enough, the people who study this sort of thing tell us that of the 4 accounts of the life of Jesus that we find in the New Testament, so we've got Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, only John tells us anything specific about Philip. Like in the other Gospels, his name shows up on a list of the original 12, but John gives us quite a bit of detail about Philip, and the scholars that study this sort of thing tell us that that actually makes sense because the original audience for John's Gospel or account of the life of Jesus was the Roman province of Asia Minor, or what we call Turkey today. So the first people to receive John's Gospel would have heard of Philip or maybe even would have known Philip. So as it turns out, knowing a little bit about Philip can actually help us understand the significance of what happened to him in Hierapolis. And so what I want to do for a few minutes is to give you a sense of how John describes Philip and his faith journey, because I think what you're going to see is that his life becomes a powerful, powerful thing whenever you find doubt happening within your faith. So that said, here's what John recorded about Philip. He introduced him to us this way. He wrote that one day, after Jesus had called 4 guys named Peter and Andrew and James and John to follow him to become his disciples, Jesus met Philip and gave him an invitation that apparently, based on what Philip already knew about Jesus, he couldn't refuse. And the invitation to Philip, just 2 words, Jesus looks at Philip and says, follow me. In other words, Jesus says, Philip, I want you to become my apprentice. I want you to live with me, to learn from me, to watch me, because ultimately I want you to become like me, to be the same sort of person that I am in the world. And based on what Philip had already seen and experienced of Jesus, he had heard him teach, he had watched him heal, he immediately accepted the invitation, like without reservation. And as John's account continues, we learn something else. We learn that Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Now, Bethsaida is a small fishing village right on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, a couple hundred people at best in the first century. So Jesus calls three guys from this city of Bethsaida, and John also tells us that Philip found Nathanael, another guy, and told him, and this is huge, we have found the one Moses wrote about in the law, like 1,500 years ago, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. In other words, immediately upon accepting the invitation to follow Jesus, Philip ran and found his friend Nathanael and expressed his faith that Jesus was the one that the children of Israel had been waiting for hundreds and hundreds of years. He was Israel's long-promised Messiah. In the Greek, the word is Christ. He was the long-awaited final king that God had sent to lead the children of Israel. And again, it was all written about in the Old Testament and in the prophets. Now, I love that John recorded not only Philip's enthusiastic endorsement of Jesus, but also Nathanael's underwhelming response to the suggestion that Jesus was the Messiah. Might have been even a bit offensive. Check out, Nathanael says, Nazareth? Like, can anything good come from there? In other words, Nathanael totally dogged Jesus' hometown, right? And I'm not sure that was a good idea, but fortunately for Nathanael, Jesus was incredibly gracious and did not immediately skadoosh him from afar, Kung Fu Panda style, if you're familiar with the movie. If you're not, you need to watch it. It's great. Anyway, after this conversation with Nathanael, Philip began to follow Jesus. Again, he would hear him teach. He would watch him interact with people. He would watch him heal. And eventually, as John's account unfolds, Philip shows up again, but not because of his faith. He actually shows up because of his doubt. So check this out. One day, Jesus and his disciples travel out into the countryside somewhere north of the Sea of Galilee, very near Nathanael's hometown and Philip's hometown, when they realize that they're being followed. So John recorded what happened this way. He said, when Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming towards him, he said to Philip, where shall we buy bread for these people to eat? It's like, you're from around here, lots of people, what are we going to do? But I love this detail. John says, he asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Love it. So Philip answered him, it would take more than half a year's wage to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite. Like, Jesus, there's a lot of people here, right? I mean, and I know the area, and I know the bakers, but there's no way that they have that much bread on hand, let alone that we have the money to pay for the bread. In other words, Jesus, I'm sorry, where should we buy bread for these people? You've got to be kidding me. Like, what in the world are you talking about? And what I take from this conversation is that apparently, although Philip understood Jesus to be the long prophesied final king of Israel, he had somehow missed that this Messiah would be so much more than just a man, that somehow he would be Emmanuel, like God with us. And one of the Old Testament prophets, a guy named Isaiah, actually said as much of the Messiah around 700 years before the time of Jesus in the Old Testament account that bears his name. So here's what Isaiah wrote as a prophecy. He said, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. And we talk about this at Christmas time every year. Emmanuel means God with us, which means that if Jesus really was the Messiah and the Messiah really was Emmanuel, God with us, then feeding people with bread from heaven wouldn't be much of a challenge for him at all. I mean, God had done that for 40 years for the children of Israel when they were in the wilderness. If he really was Emmanuel, if that was his identity, then anything was possible. But see, Philip hadn't yet understood what it meant that Jesus was the Messiah, that that was his identity. And actually, Jesus' identity was the essence of the final conversation recorded by John that took place between Jesus and Philip. And so here's how that one happened. On the night that Jesus was arrested by the Jewish religious leaders, shortly after he had a Last Supper with his first disciples, and you may remember that Leonardo da Vinci was there, painted a nice picture for us, right? Yeah, that Last Supper. So after the meal, Jesus looks at his disciples, trying to comfort them because he knows what's coming. They don't know what's coming. He looks at them and says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me." And we, like, when we read this, we go, what a nice thing for Jesus to say, right? But I'm telling you, his disciples would have been absolutely stunned because Jesus just essentially told them, "Hey guys, I want you to trust me just like you trust God." And from the perspective of those first disciples, Jesus' words could only be one of two things. They were incredibly blasphemous, or they were true. There was really no other way to think about them. I mean, they would have been stunned and confused and quite possibly offended. But I know they were offended when Jesus kept talking, because check out what he says next. He says, "If you really know me, you will know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him." In other words, guys, you need to get this. The more you know me, the more you know him. And just let that sink in for a minute. I mean, Jesus told his disciples, "If you've seen me, you've seen God." And it's at this point in the conversation that, as I imagine it, Philip slowly raises his hand and says very respectfully, "Lord, not sure what you're talking about. Why don't we do this? Show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." And again, Philip wasn't trying to be impolite here. He was legitimately confused. So we have to remember something. A few weeks before this conversation, Jesus had literally raised a man named Lazarus from the dead in the presence of his disciples. And so during this conversation, they would have been well aware that Jesus was more than just a man. But see, the idea that he might actually be God in a human body, that would have been an absolutely overwhelming thing for them to consider. And so Philip just says to Jesus, "Can you please just clarify? I need to know if you really meant what you just said, because if you meant what you just said, man, that changes everything." And we also have to remember something else. Like, all of Jesus' original disciples, they were Jewish, and because of that, they had grown up with an image of God that had been informed by the Old Testament text. And as helpful as the Old Testament texts and narratives are when coming to understand God, there was still a lot of mystery in the Jewish mind surrounding God and how he worked. And so on the day Jesus was arrested, his disciples would have been absolutely convinced that he had come from God, and they would have been absolutely convinced that he was the long-awaited Messiah. But see, the idea that to be with him was to be with God would have been more than they could get their minds around. And I think that's why Philip said to Jesus, "Hey, just can you show us the Father?" And as I imagine it, in response, Jesus would have looked at Philip and thought, "Bro, what do you think I've been doing for the past 3 years, right?" But see, he's Jesus. He's not sarcastic like me, so he didn't say that. He said something much more Jesus-y. Here's what he said. "Don't you know me, Philip? So show us the Father. Don't you know me, Philip? Even after I've been with you for such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father." Like, how can you say, "Show us the Father"? And I'm telling you, I mean, every time I read this passage and I reflect on it, like, the hair on the back of my neck stands up. This statement is so full of wonder and awe and mystery and hope and peace. I mean, think about it. Jesus was speaking the truth that day to his disciples. And so the implications of this reality are absolutely astonishing. It means for you and me, as well as the disciples, that the closest we can get to understanding what God is like is Jesus. If we want to understand how he feels about something, we should look to Jesus. So that said, check out what Jesus said as he continued. He said, "Don't you believe that I'm in the Father and the Father's in me?" He says, "The words I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority. Rather, it's the Father living in me who's doing his work. So believe me when I say that I'm in the Father and the Father's in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves. Jesus says, listen, the miracles carried a message that I was more than a man. And I know we're pushing you farther than you can really go, but that's what these miracles were about. Yes, I was helping people and healing people and showing people what things would ultimately be like when peace is restored. But see, I'm also trying to tell you who I am. If you've seen me, you've seen him. And if you've heard me, you've heard him. And if you've watched me, you've watched him. That's one of the reasons I came. He wants you to know him. He wants you to know him in a personal way. And I know you've read the accounts of what he's done in the past, but as unbelievable as it sounds, he has come to dwell among you because I have come to dwell among you. So you want to know what God is like? Just watch me. Listen to me. Lean in. And as clear as Jesus was in this conversation, I am convinced the disciples still would have struggled with Jesus' words. I mean, they would have thought, how can this possibly be? How can he possibly be God in human form? And then as they were sort of shell-shocked thinking about the implications of all this and what they would do with all of this, Jesus stood up from the place where they had had dinner, walked out of the city gates of Jerusalem, down through a valley and halfway up a hill to a garden where he would be arrested before being tried and convicted and sentenced to death. And then at 9 a.m. the next morning, that's right when the morning sacrifice happened in the temple in Jerusalem, Jesus was nailed to a cross. And then as the sun set on that first Good Friday, Philip and those other disciples would have been absolutely devastated and confused and terrified. I mean, the one who they had been convinced was the Messiah, the one who had just claimed to be God in flesh, had been betrayed by one of them and accused and tried and convicted and crucified, and then his body had been placed in a tomb, and a massive stone had sealed that tomb. And so on the night of that first Good Friday, if you were to have interviewed those disciples, they would have said to you, man, the story of Jesus is over. It didn't go where we thought it was going to go. It didn't go where we hoped it was going to go, but it's over. And they would have been in shock. I mean, I would have been too if I had been among them. I mean, they had believed that Jesus had been sent by God to restore Israel to prominence on the world stage. And they had thought they were days away of becoming the inner circle of the most powerful man the world had ever known. But see, then in a moment, in an instant, everything changed when Jesus was crucified. And as they understood it, that should not have happened, especially if he really was who he said he was. And so after Jesus' arrest, the gospel writers tell us that everybody but John ran for their lives and hid somewhere in the city of Jerusalem, convinced that their relationship with Jesus and very likely their lives were over. But then, as many of you know, a few days later, something happened that nobody was expecting. And John actually recorded the moment when the disciples learned of what that something was. He wrote, on the evening of that first day of the week, that Sunday evening, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jews, and I would argue the fear that at any minute Roman guards could come crashing through the door and arrest them for their role in the Jesus movement. I mean, if Rome had decided they were going to stop the Jesus movement, why wouldn't they stop the followers of Jesus as well? So they had a lot of fear. And I would imagine they were pondering the uncomfortable reality that their lives might very well end in the same way that Jesus' life had ended. And in that moment, John tells us that Jesus came and stood among them, and I love this, and he said, peace be with you. Now, anytime there's an angelic or unexpected visitor of the heavenly realm in the Bible, you always hear two things. You either hear, do not fear, or peace be with you. And do you know why you hear, do not fear, or peace be with you? Jesus had to say this to his disciples because they would have freaked out. I mean, when a guy that you know died on a cross shows up a couple days later and greets you, I would argue that it's always a bit unnerving. Would you agree? Yeah. In fact, I suspect that a few of them needed to excuse themselves to change out their undergarments, right? Yeah. But as John's account continues, we learn that Jesus wanted his disciples to know that it was really him. It wasn't a ghost. It wasn't an apparition. It wasn't a vision. And so he tells us that after he said this, he showed them his hands and side, like where he had been wounded. And then the disciples, the fear turns to joy. He says the disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Like, I don't know how, but he's back. And then again, Jesus said, peace be with you. And then this is huge. He says, as the Father has sent me, I am sending you. In other words, guys, you thought that this story was over, but it's only getting started. You are going to take the news of what I have accomplished to the ends of the earth. I mean, to Jerusalem, the city we're in, and to Judea, that's the region, and Samaria, that's the region to the north. But then we're taking this thing worldwide because this is good news of great joy for all people. And again, we're taking it to the ends of the earth. And if you're here in the first week of the series, you remember that to the Jewish mind, the ends of the earth was Turkey. Which brings me back to the martyrium of Philip at Hierapolis. Because according to church tradition, Philip and his family moved to Hierapolis from Jerusalem sometime in the mid to late first century, a couple of decades after Paul first touched ground in Turkey. And so Philip and his family move there, and they begin to teach, they begin to introduce people to Jesus, to talk about his life and his death and his resurrection and this new way that they were being invited to live in light of that. And as the Jesus movement begins to grow in numbers and in influence, the city's mayor, who also served as sort of the head of the Roman province that included Hierapolis, began to see Christianity as a threat, both to the pagan religious authorities and the local leaders whose power and economic interests were tied to the worship of the pagan gods. Hierapolis was a major center for pagan worship in the first century. Additionally, some sources suggest that Philip, at some point early in his time in Hierapolis, performed a very public miracle by healing a prominent member of the community, and that enraged both the pagan priests and the local officials. And so again, the mayor is just watching all this unfold, and it keeps getting worse and worse from his perspective. And eventually, the mayor came to believe that Christianity in general, and Philip in particular, were threats to the peace of Hierapolis. And so what he decided to do was arrest Philip and try him and then have him publicly crucified. As I was prepping for today, I even found an ancient account that said that as Philip was on the cross and people gathered, he continued to tell them about Jesus and the resurrection and how in light of Jesus and in light of the resurrection, none of this matters anymore. And what's fascinating, you say, well, what happened? I mean, you take the leader out of the movement in Hierapolis. What happened to the Christians in Hierapolis? Did they turn away from Jesus in mass and return to paganism? No, the opposite. Within 120 years, 80% of Turkey was following Jesus. And if you said, where were the sparks that ignited that fire? One of them was right here in Hierapolis. And so Hierapolis turns to Christianity, Turkey turns to Christianity, and then around the year 400, when it became legal for the first time, followers of Jesus built the martyrium to Philip as a place of pilgrimage for people who wanted to honor his memory and his legacy and his testimony. Which brings me to, I think, a really important question. I mean, how in the world do you take a teenager from a small fishing village in the north of Israel and give him enough passion, enough chutzpah in Hebrew, to walk 1,200 miles from home, to exit a rural hometown, to enter a major Roman city, and then to preach and to love and to serve and to live in such a way that death doesn't matter anymore? It is an absolutely incredible, undeniable historical reality. Philip was willing to do whatever it took to let as many people as he could know the truth about Jesus and his resurrection. And here's what else is compelling. It wasn't just Philip. According to church tradition, Peter, Andrew, Thaddeus, and Simon were all crucified. A few of them upside down because they didn't count themselves worthy of being crucified in the same way as Jesus. James, Matthias, Thaddeus, and Bartholomew were beheaded. Matthew was stabbed in the back. And Thomas was speared to death, all because they refused to deny the resurrection of Jesus. So that's like the 12, the inner circle. But then there's Paul, the guy who wrote most of the letters that make up our New Testament. I mean, after he met Jesus, the resurrected Jesus on the road to Damascus, and we talked about that in week one, his life was never the same. It was completely transformed. Like, we don't tend to think about it a lot, but Paul had to walk many, many miles as he took the message of Jesus to the Roman world. I mean, according to scholars, on his first journey into the Roman world, he traveled 1,200 miles, the vast majority of it on foot. On his second, he traveled another 2,800 miles, much of that on foot. His third, 2,700 miles, considerable overland walking. And on his final journey to Rome, 2,200 miles with significant portions on foot. All that to say, though exact figures are hard to determine, they estimate that at least half of Paul's travels, or 5,000 miles, were literally walked, given the limited availability of transportation and the ruggedness of the terrain in the first century. I mean, Paul's journeys took him across mountain ranges, through deserts, and along countless miles of paved Roman roads. In addition to all the walking, in a letter to early Christians in Greece, Paul actually makes a powerful confession. He's talking about his experience in sharing Jesus with the world. And you go, well, Paul, he's famous, right? We talk about him 2,000 years later, halfway around the world. I mean, fame and fortune must have followed him all the days of his life. Not exactly. Here's how he described it. He said, I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, have been flogged more severely, and have been exposed to death again and again. He says, 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. And we're like, that's kind of weird. They believe 40 lashes would kill you. 39, just almost kill you. And he did that 5 times. He goes on. 3 times, I was beaten with rods. Once, I was pelted with stones. 3 times, I was shipwrecked. I don't know about you. I might be like, let's not sail. You know, I mean, it's like 3 times. 3 times, I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles. Real quick, Jew plus Gentile equals everybody, okay, in danger from Gentiles, in danger from the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false believers. I have labored and toiled and often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I've been cold and I've been naked. But Paul would go on to say, but Jesus is worth it. Jesus changed everything, and Jesus changes everything. And he is my Lord, and he is my King, and he is worthy of whatever I can do to help people know the truth. All that to say, Jesus' first disciples were willing to do whatever it took to bring the good news of what he had accomplished to the ends of the earth. In fact, I think it's one of the best evidences for the literal historical resurrection of Jesus, not the resurrection as parable, but like the literal historical resurrection of Jesus, is the unrelenting commitment of his first disciples. I mean, think about it. They were absolutely convinced that he was alive again. And so they were willing to make whatever sacrifices necessary to tell the world. Which, of course, brings me to the title for this talk, which I was so excited about. Okay, it's in your books, but how far would they take a lie? How far would they take a lie? They didn't find fame and fortune. They found lots of trouble, lots of persecution from the Romans, from the Jews. How far would they take a lie? In other words, if Jesus didn't literally rise from the grave, the lives of his first followers and the deaths of his first followers make no sense at all. And the implication for you and me 2,000 years later, halfway around the world, the implication is staggering. I mean, think about it this way. Historically speaking, there is an unbroken chain of witnesses to the reality that Jesus rose from the grave. Said a bit differently, somebody told you because somebody told them because somebody told them. And if you travel back on the chain to that first link, the people who saw the resurrected Jesus with their own eyes, and if their testimony is trustworthy, then the whole chain holds, and we can have confidence in the literal historical resurrection of Jesus. And that matters for you and me, because for most of us, there will be moments, maybe seasons in life, when we doubt. We doubt God's goodness to us because of something that happened, or maybe we just start to wonder if the whole Jesus thing was just a story that someone made up. But I'm telling you, because of the testimony of those first eyewitnesses, when our faith begins to drift towards doubt, we can reground ourselves to what we can confidently affirm, that 2,000 years ago, something happened that nobody was expecting, that changed everything for everyone when Jesus' body wasn't where it was supposed to be. Because he had risen from the dead, and his disciples were willing to pay any price to tell the world the good news. And that, my friends, is the lesson that I take from the martyrium of Philip. And we'll pick it up there next week. But for now, if you're here in the room, I'd love to invite you to stand, and I'll close our time in prayer. Also this week, we'll have some friends on the screen to the left. If you need some prayer, we'd love to spend some time hearing a little bit about your story and just praying for you. So would you join me? Heavenly Father, in moments like this, I find myself filled with wonder that you came among us so that we might have a glimpse of who you are, how good you are, how much you love, and that you are for us, all of us. And so we thank you for the trustworthy testimony of those first followers of Jesus. We stand in their debt, but because we can trust their testimony. And so for today, we bless you. We thank you. We love you and desire to reflect your goodness and your love to our world. It is in the matchless name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ, we pray. And everyone said, amen. It's been good to be with you, friends. We'll see you next week.